This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. It's Friday, which means we take some time to dive beneath the headlines and talk about the big news of the week. And for the second week in a row, it is heartbreaking. Here's NBC News.
It was at 11:30 that the police department gets the first 911 call. He then enters the school at 11:40, they say.
That's a story that feels all too familiar.
I'd hoped when I became president, I would not have to do this again. Another massacre. Uvalde, Texas. An elementary school.
This isn't inevitable. These kids weren't unlucky. This only happens in this country and nowhere else. Nowhere else do little kids go to school thinking that they might be shot that day.
And even when it happens thousands of miles away, it still hits home hard.
We work with the Boston Public Schools, and we will be assessing whatever security measures they have in every single school in the city.
Dismissal time at the Condon School in South Boston, and parents admit to worrying about their children a little more today.
One of my parishioners said, I just can't send my kids to school today. You know, and so folks are praying with her and for her.
Sound there from WBZ TV and Reverend Mariama White Hammond of the New Roots AME Church in Dorchester. Here on the show before that, of course, you heard President Biden and Democratic Senator Chris Murphy from Connecticut. Now, the Texas elementary school shooting came just 10 days after the supermarket massacre in Buffalo, and we are all hurting. And in moments of true crisis, we often turn to our leaders for comfort and to try to address the feelings of helplessness in order to channel that hurt and rage into something more productive. So yesterday afternoon, we invited Massachusetts Congresswoman and Assistant Speaker of the House, Catherine Clark, to join us here in the studio. And I started by asking her, how's she doing?
Pretty terrible, yeah. Actually. You know, I look across the country and the landscape, the threats to our very democracy, to women's freedom and equality, and to our tolerance of the massacre of children in classrooms, of our elders at the grocery store, of people gathering to worship. It is a pretty grim landscape in our country at this moment.
Do you feel like, do you feel collectively, if you look at the whole collective of the United States, do you feel we do have tolerance of the shooting in Uvalde and the shooting at the Topps grocery store in Buffalo? Do you feel as a country we are tolerant?
I think there is a huge disconnect between those in Congress who have the power to act and communities, our neighbors at home across the country. We need all people who understand that we are the only country in the world that has this problem with mass shootings and school shootings, to demand that their elected leaders act. This is the time. We are out of excuses. And to me, as I look across the aisle, if you will not act to keep communities safe, to perform that fundamental duty of your job, I don't think you deserve to be reelected and to serve people in that capacity.
Is it that raw across the aisle? I mean, I've heard some things. Okay, well, here, let me backtrack. Let me play Connecticut Senator Chris Murphy on the floor of the Senate this week.
Why do you spend all this time running for the United States Senate? Why do you go through all the hassle of getting this job, of putting yourself in a position of authority? If your answer is that as this slaughter increases, as our kids run for their lives, we do nothing.
You know, I noted that last night he had a tweet out at about 10:30 at night, then talking about trying to find common ground in the Senate, of course, with people across the aisle. And I wonder in this moment, sometimes we hear that common ground thing. Sometimes we hear that anger. Sometimes we see profanity from our lawmakers now directed at each other. How do we... You know what? At the 800th time, how do we get anywhere when we're that divided? And What do you think about when you're feeling that kind of anger? But you also, we got to find a way to move forward. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Exactly. And I think we see this mirrored back to us in the American people who are deeply frustrated. The pandemic has been hard. 60% of our school children here in Massachusetts have lost a loved one. 60%. And that kind of trauma, the economic suffering that people had, the loss of social connection, just compounds all the existing problems and challenges that we have to tackle in this country. But I think what we have to do is lead with community. People are desperate for it. They don't want to be told who they should hate, that they shouldn't like their neighbor. They want to find a way to come together. And what is so deeply frustrating is to see with the shooting in Buffalo that we had a leader in House Republican Party, Elise Stefanik, who wouldn't even acknowledge
from New York,
that wouldn't even acknowledge that she should maybe take down the ads that were promoting for her campaign the idea of the replacement theory. That is exactly what motivated and radicalized the shooter in Buffalo.
Now, she would argue that she wasn't promoting replacement theory.
And when she made that argument, she called those who disagreed with her grifter pedophiles. So, you know, how do we come back together? I will work with anyone who's willing to work with American families and work on their behalf to address those kitchen table issues, to make sure that we do everything we can. We know with 400 million guns in this country, it is really hard to prevent all future mass shootings. But this unwillingness to even try to block research into what tools can work, what strategies can be effective for reducing gun violence, and hiding behind the Second Amendment, it is depraved behavior. And when we have the trauma that these shootings cause, not only in Texas and in that small town, but across the country as they hear about these atrocities, we have to do better. And if you're not going to fight for families, then we need to replace you in the halls of Congress.
So a couple of questions from there. And this question is kind of forming in my mind as I'm listening to you. We know that we have a set of systemic problems that force our Congress apart, right? Our primary system brings forward candidates who are on the far ends of their parties, who then have disincentives to compromise, and we come into Congress that way. We know that's an issue. We also know there are very strong lobbies on some of these issues that are creating pressure. You said a couple of minutes ago, I will work with anybody who wants to help support American families. We also know that heading into an election in November, there are structural incentives not to compromise because you need your base to turn out, not necessarily you in particular, but in general. And I wonder in this moment, what is the countercultural step that your assistant speaker, you as a leader, other members of Congress can make, regardless of what side of the aisle they sit on? And how do we get some of those countercultural steps made now, given the incredible systemic forces that sit on top of Congress people? And then some of my listeners would, I think, would say, well, you're making excuses with those systemic forces. But we understand the reality. We've been here a while. Where does that countercultural move come from? How does it start?
I think we focus on those kitchen table issues. That is how we come together, or at least we should be able to, and draw a clear line for voters on whose side are you on. Let's take health care. You know, we have just expanded the ACA by over 15 million people. And we know that in 2017, there was a huge effort to take away the ACA from people. So you're going to work on healthcare? Are you going to work on making sure that people can access what they need, including mental health care, or are you not? And so when I say, you know, let's find those areas we can work on, that has gotten so difficult. When I first came into Congress, I was the most junior member of the minority party. And I worked across the aisle on the opioid crisis because that was an issue I could find partners with. Those people have either transformed, like Elise Stefanik, into someone I don't recognize, or have left Congress because they no longer could see a place for themselves in this Congress. And January 6th made that even worse. This party, the GOP, has become a radical party. Some of the white nationalism and white supremacy isn't just a one-off. It has become a pillar of what they campaign on. And if we are leading with fear and division and calls to violence, that is exactly what we are going to get. So I try to still work with the people who are willing to work together. But let's look at one example, the infrastructure bill, a bill that always was able to find consensus across the aisle.
The big Build Back Better one?
The big infrastructure bill, yeah, because all of these things are important to families across our country. Roads and bridges, creating great jobs, expanding broadband, getting the lead out of water. There is nothing controversial in this bill. And yet, it was seen as somehow a win for President Biden, and therefore only 13 House members on the Republican side voted for it, and then their own colleagues were demanding they be stripped of their committees, they received death threats because they voted for infrastructure. So how do we find common ground when the GOP has been so radicalized? And those members who aren't are far too often silent and complicit.
So we have a large collection of powerful Democrats in Congress from Massachusetts. You just talked about the transformation of the Republican Party. So I want to ask you, in the last 10 years, has the Democratic Party transformed? And are there things where the Democratic Party has gone too far left to find common ground as well in your mind?
I would say the Democratic Party continues to be the party of families that are putting those basic economic issues. Can you get a good job that allows you to feed your family and provide a quality of life? Do you have safe schools that are going to open up opportunities for your children? Can you find and afford childcare when you need it? Do you have the health care coverage you need? And what we're seeing is those basic issues, we have come together as a big party. We've always been a big tent party that has a lot of diversity within it, but that is our strength when we continue to come together and pass complex pieces of legislation. And no, I don't think that expanding our food program to feed hungry kids here in Massachusetts and around the country is too far left. I don't think working really hard to make sure that women and women alone have the right to make the most intimate and personal choice about having a child is too far left.
So you know those aren't the places of pushback. The places of pushback are on things like police reform and defunding the police.
I'm going to stop you there and push back on that, because defunding police has never been something that we have seen from Congress. Addressing police brutality, making sure that every mom feels the security. I worry about tons of things for my kids. But I have three white children. I don't worry about them interacting with the police. And every mom should have that security. And the proposals we've put around police reform have also been matched with making sure that municipalities have the funding they need to have police protection, to expand it. Democrats were not the ones out there saying, we don't want to fund the police departments. We don't want to help municipalities in the middle of the pandemic crisis. So, you know, I think there is a lot of rhetoric that the Republican Party uses that has been you know, absorbed into our culture, into our media. But that is not the work that is being done by House Democrats. We are about security of communities. We are about making sure that people have opportunities. We're about reducing the cost of their health care, whether through, you know, just take the insulin bill that we passed, capping it at $35 a month. Why is that possibly controversial with my Republican colleagues?
You are underscoring another piece of the problem. And I get that this is a gnarly moment, right? I get it. You gave a litany of things that the party cares about. You know, do you have affordable health care? Do you have child care? And we know that there are a lot of people in the country right now who will say no. No, I don't. No, I don't. No,
That's
I
right.
don't. And we are in a moment where the Democratic Party controls the House, the Senate, and the White House. So if at this moment, when that's the platform, there's so much of America saying, no, I don't have that. What is the path forward? I mean, it's already all three branches.
Well, I would argue we do not have control of the Senate majority because we have a filibuster rule. So to have control, you need 60 votes. We have 50. And so until we have a majority in the Senate that is willing to change that rule, to go back to when our Constitution calls for a supermajority, which is very rare circumstances, it is a 60-vote majority in the Senate, and that is why you have seen the House come together over and over again, whether it's cutting the cost of prescription drugs, moving forward on addressing climate change, building resiliency in our cities and towns and communities, and also building an economic powerhouse in green technology. Those issues are just failing to clear the Senate because the majority in the Senate, for all purposes, is 60 votes.
So I'm going to pivot us now. I mean, we could stay in that space for a really long time, and I know you live in that space, right? But I am mindful that you are a woman leader in this Congress. You've just come today from an abortion clinic, a clinic that provides abortions. I don't like to frame it as an abortion clinic. A clinic that provides abortions. Roe v. Wade is sitting out there with a leaked draft opinion. Women's health is an issue that you have been vocal on from the beginning. And I want you to tell me where your head and heart are right now.
You know, my heart is broken. Reading that opinion, it is hard to believe that we are where we are in 2022 in the United States. We are on the verge of rolling back a major right for women, for families, for the people of this country. We have not always moved forward well, but we have never been in a situation where we are going to take back a right. And what I heard from the providers that I just came from meeting with is a true fear, a fear of these criminal laws, a fear of what will happen to themselves, to their own families, and a fear of what's going to happen to patients.
So here in the Commonwealth, at the state level, there are strong abortion rights laws enshrined. Do you think fear from local providers is appropriate? Is not appropriate, that founded. That's the word I'm looking for.
I do, because what they are concerned about is the criminalization of providing health care as they see women coming from around the country to seek health care here.
Could that be criminalized here, given who
that
we
is,
are?
That is their fear.
Wouldn't it be
a Massachusetts law, but what will the impact be if you provide care to someone from a state that has criminalized the provision of abortion? You know, there's research to be done. We are going to look into all angles of that, but I don't think that's an unfounded fear. And we also are very aware that we are hearing from Republican leaders in Congress that if they have the majority, a federal ban on abortion is part of their agenda. We won't be safe in this case if that passes. That will impact Massachusetts as well as every other state in this country. And we have to stop and think about what we are saying. We know that women, most women who have abortions in this country are low income, they're young, and they're already moms. And if we are serious about having women in our economy, women be able to continue their education, provide for their families, to be part of our culture and independent and make their own decisions in accordance with their beliefs, their faith, that is all in jeopardy with this decision we've seen.
Do you hear from any constituents in your district who, you know, I'm always bringing it back home here, any constituents in your district who are in support of the Supreme Court rolling back Roe v. Wade?
I do.
What do they tell you?
For most of them, it is a deeply held religious conviction. And I respect that. And I respect the sincerity of their beliefs. But we have separation of church and state in this country. And we have to remember that that is also a principle of our Constitution and our laws. And so I respect their sincerity and their beliefs, and I don't doubt that. But we have to make sure that we are also understanding that this is truly an economic issue. Abortion care is a kitchen table economic issue for many, many women. And as we look and are making this evaluation in the midterms of who are going to be our leaders, let's look at their support for children and moms. Going back to those healthcare plans I was talking about in 2017, 12 alternative plans proposed. Not a single one of them covered maternity benefits. Not a single one.
So let's hit a couple building blocks, just kind of in a rapid fire. So we had Reverend Mariama White Hammond of the New Roots AME Church in Dorchester on the show. And she talked about a vision in our region for a pro-child region. So top of mind, four policies that turns Massachusetts into the most pro-child state in the union.
Child care. There are many things that we can talk about, and I think that is just a perfect frame. Let's all be pro-child. If we're pro-child, we can move this country in ways, we can close these divisions, we can come together around our children. But for me, it does start with childcare and universal preschool. We know this is one of the most effective tools to fight poverty and to fight stress that we see on young kids and get them ready to learn so that they're reading at grade level by third grade, and that unlocks their education and a lifetime of learning. So childcare also is great for employers. It is great for moms and dads who need childcare so they can go to work knowing that children are well cared for. It is basic economic infrastructure. Traditional wealthy countries put $15,000 a year into offsetting costs for a toddler. Here in the United States, we put in $500. We have to keep up with the rest of the globe and understand how fundamental this is. We also have to do something about gun safety. Children dying from gunshots is now the leading cause of death for our kids and our teens. The leading cause of death. And if you add up childhood diseases, overdoses, AIDS, it is still combined. Gunshots outstrip that. And so we can't talk about these things like they're in different silos. This is literally killing our children. And it is not just mass shootings. It's suicides. It's other kinds of homicides. It's just the mass shootings are so horrific and so public. So we have to be serious about protecting our children from gun violence. We have to build a climate and address climate change so they have a future and a planet.
I want to bring us back to kids for one more minute. I have a very specific question for you on the baby formula issue. And just to give a little bit of context to the listeners who may not recall, we're experiencing a massive shortage in baby formula, according to an organization called Data Assembly. At the beginning of the month, about 43% of the baby formula supply in the country was out of stock. Right. And that is the result of a production facility in Michigan being shut down after a long process of whistleblowing and the FDA responding and then checking it out. And the conditions in the factory were extreme, standing water, leaking, lack of sanitary conditions, et cetera. Is there an accountability moment for the FDA, who got a whistleblower call in September, didn't talk to the whistleblower till December. The factory doesn't shut down till February. We find out the safety and sanitation conditions were bad. What's the accountability moment for the FDA now?
Yeah, I mean, this is the moment. And we are having them in practically every day for hearings because we need to have these questions answered. And we need to look at how we buy formula in this country and how we ensure that it is not only safe, but that people can get what they need to feed their babies. And this particular plant in Sturgis, Michigan, it was appalling, the conditions. Children died, we believe, because of the formula that they ingested from these plants.
Although I do want to note that the bacterial signature, it sounds like, wasn't the same in the formula as what they found in the plant. Is that not correct?
That is correct. So there may not be a direct line, but there were certainly lots of warnings about this plant and the conditions. But we also have very few with the WIC program that buys 50% of the formula in this country. Families buy it through that program. There's very few suppliers. So where was the redundancy in the system? Where was the planning that if you were going to shut this down, why weren't you more responsive to the whistleblower? And what was the plan to a disruption was obvious. What was the plan to make sure there was formula that families could access to feed their children? I can tell you the panicked calls that we got in my office of just, I can't imagine anything more frantic than feeling like you might not have what your child needs to survive. And, you know, this is in the United States, in Massachusetts. We should be able to do this. Now, we have taken action. We are importing. That formula has arrived in the United States and is being distributed. To what we are being told now from the administration, the shortage is alleviated and people have what they need. But there are some real questions going forward about what happened here. What are the steps we're going to take to ensure that this never happens again?
All right. As we wrap, at the beginning, you said it's a tough time. So in a sentence, what's a piece of joy that you're holding in your heart that you would share with other people?
Oh, my gosh. It always comes back to our children. And it always comes back to not only my own children and the incredible joy they provide me, but into touring schools, meeting kids throughout Massachusetts. They are our future. They're worth fighting for. And that's exactly what I'm going to do.
And that is Congresswoman Catherine Clark, who is Assistant Speaker of the House, represents Massachusetts' 5th District, which includes Waltham, Framingham, Medford, Woburn. Congressman Clark, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.